Right now, on Current State, the sexual harassment scandals hit home here in Michigan. A longtime Detroit columnist tells us the lessons she hopes we are all learning.
Our country is going through an awakening, and there's a reckoning, and it's about time.
Also, find out why high-speed internet access may be hard to find, even as close as Ann Arbor.
A pilot who couldn't even download links from his airline's website to give him his next flight assignment.
Security is going to the dogs at MSU. You'll hear why that's a good thing. A candid conversation with two high school football players who kneeled during the national anthem.
I couldn't be a student there. I didn't feel good as a student. I didn't feel good walking through the halls.
And the new edition aimed at making our drive in Michigan snowstorms a bit safer this winter. Current State starts right after the news. From the WKAR studios at Michigan State University, welcome to Current State. Hello there, I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. From the media to Capitol Hill, America is dealing with the disturbing and pervasive issue of sexual harassment. Here's just a few excerpts from newscasts in the past week.
This morning, several more women have leveled sexual misconduct allegations against Matt Lauer.
Radio personality Garrison Keillor has been fired from Minnesota Public Radio over allegations of improper behavior.
Multiple women have now accused 88-year-old Michigan Democratic Congressman John Conyers of sexual
misconduct. And now the scandals are swirling around Michigan. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi and fellow Michigan Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee have both asked Conyers to resign. But on Friday, Conyers attorney Arnold Reed again denied any wrongdoing and hinted Conyers may make a statement once he leaves the hospital for treatment of stress.
He will continue to defend himself until the cows come home, because unequivocally, unmitigatedly, he is indicating he has not sexually harassed anyone. And it will be Congressman John Conyers who will be the one to decide what it is he is going to do in terms of whether he's going to continue to represent the people. It's not going to be Washington.
Let's talk more about this right now with Stephen Henderson at WDET in Detroit. He hosts Detroit Today. Welcome to Current State.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
From your understanding, what is the latest and how is the community reacting to all of this news with this icon of Detroit?
Yeah, well, there was a lot of news this week. We had the initial accuser of Congressman Conyers come out and say that she wanted to be speaking out and have her name attached finally to the accusations that she's made. She went on the Today Show on NBC on Thursday. She did our show Thursday afternoon, which we aired on Friday morning. Marion Brown, the accuser of Congressman John Conyers, told us that the culture in his office was part of what led up to the inappropriate interactions between her and the congressman.
At one time, it was said amongst staff members, females, that he thinks his initials, JC, stands for Jesus Christ. I have no reason to lie on him. There's no incentive. I mean, he's an African-American. He's a Democrat. I am too. And I do say, I'm not taking away from the fact that he is a civil rights icon. You know, he's just on the wrong side of, you know, his personal behavior is unacceptable.
Meanwhile, the congressman continues to deny that any of this happened, and his lawyers are very adamant in repeating those denials. And he was also hospitalized this week, they said, for stress related to all of this. You add in the calls for him to resign, and it really has been the sort of central news item of the week. And lots of people are sort of anticipating that the next thing, the next shoe to drop, could be an announcement that he will no longer serve in the Congress.
Do you feel like the community is torn, or is that kind of resolving?
No, I think if you talk to people in his district, I had a conversation with Don Gagne, the national political correspondent for NPR, who's been in town all week, talking to people in his district, and he said that lots of people are standing by the congressman. Lots of people feel a deep attachment to him still for the things that he did in the past. They think that he's the right person to be representing them now and in the future, and they're almost resentful of the idea that people might suggest that he resign in the wake of these allegations. I mean, I think it's hard to overstate the relationship that John Conyers has with this community. We talk all the time about it being 53 years that he served in Congress. But you go back before he was running for Congress, this is somebody who had a deep connection with Detroiters, who had a deep connection with social justice issues in Detroit. And there are a lot of people who, whether they were alive for that or not, really identify with him in that way. And it's hard to convince them that he could do anything, I think, that would necessitate him resigning from Congress.
Say he does resign, would you imagine there would be a lot of people interested in his seat?
Yeah, so that's the flip side of the deep connection that people have to Congressman Conyers. You know, it's a district that is home to a lot of other people with political ambitions, and all of them, I think, sit pretty quietly in the wings, but with a very keen eye on that seat for when it would come vacant and give them an opportunity. And so I think it would be an extremely crowded primary on the Democratic side, both inside the city of Detroit and outside. I mean, one of the things that I think not everybody remembers all the time is that he doesn't just represent Detroit. He's got a lot of suburban communities downriver, western Wayne County, where there are also people who I think are waiting for him to step aside to take a shot at his seat. So I think it would be a mad scramble to the petition day filings in that race, and we'd have a really, really competitive primary.
We've been talking with Stephen Henderson with WDET, host of Detroit Today at our fellow NPR station in Detroit. Thank you, Stephen, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Current State. Rochelle Riley is a longtime columnist for the Detroit Free Press. She is also the author of The Burden, African Americans and the Enduring Impact of Slavery, which will be released next year.
I'm thrilled to join you.
Could you share some of your thoughts about what our country is going through right now?
Our country is going through an awakening, and there's a reckoning, and it's about time. What has been made clear from California to Washington is that this is how so many women have had to live, and it shows what women have had to endure just to have their jobs, to have careers, to be able to move up wherever they were. And it's very heartbreaking, but it's also very empowering to know that this is the beginning of the end of women having to live like this.
As a longtime Detroiter, what is your perspective on the legacy of Representative Conyers, and what are these allegations coming to light possibly going to do to that?
Well, one of the things that I've been encouraging people since Nancy Pelosi's disastrous appearance on Meet the Press Sunday is we have to talk about these things in two different conversations. His legacy, over a half century of working on behalf of the poor, working on behalf of people of color, working on behalf of the Constitution, is huge, you know. But that has to be put aside, and sort of, you know, I'm not going to say anything that will last forever, like Al Gore and his lockbox. But that we need to move that over to the side and focus just on sexual allegations. As I wrote in my column, we have to get to zero tolerance of any sexual misbehavior in all of its levels, whether it's sexual misbehavior, sexual harassment, sexual abuse, sexual assault, or rape, and make sure that whatever those levels are, all of them are investigated and people are punished based on what it is. So when you're having a conversation about him and the allegations that women are making about what he did, that's not the time to talk about his legacy. We need to actually look for the end of this ethics investigation into what he did. My great fear is, you know, this huge turnaround that Pelosi did and the calls for his resignation from everyone, you know, sort of based on politics, could derail this ethics investigation, which is very important because, number one, he has denied doing anything wrong. So there must be an investigation into what he has been accused of. Number two, this agreement that he reached, you know, paying this woman $27,000 to go away, apparently, and the New York Times has, you know, called for this in a huge way on their front page, is not something that is original just to him and unique just to him, which means that there are a lot of these types of agreements. by God, we need to see every one of them. We need to find out just how many women have been silenced and how many agreements have been reached with taxpayer dollars. So the investigation itself is important.
You know, going forward, do you see things at the state level or even in businesses? Because it seems like there's a lot of high-profile cases out there, but do you think it's going to filter down?
Well, what we don't know, and this is what's interesting, is how many people have had these types of things going on in smaller companies already. If there's like some little business in Detroit where somebody spoke up and somebody's been fired, we're not going to know that because we're only interested right now in the high-profile ones. I would love to know if there's been some type of reckoning below the level of Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose and Harvey Weinstein, and that men across the country and women in instances where it applies are seeing the same level of investigation of what's going on with them. I don't know a woman who hasn't had some instance of sexual misconduct in her presence. It just depends on who they are and where they've been. And everything is not rape. Everything is not huge. But anything that keeps a woman from feeling respected and safe in the environment where she works should not be happening. So there can be lots of cases that are being handled that we don't know about.
And many people are wondering if this is a sea change moment or if it's just the hot topic for now. There's so much going on. What do you think?
All of that will depend on whether people are being held accountable. If we change the landscape so that nobody can get away with doing this, this is a watershed moment. If this is just a lot of press conferences with people saying Me Too and nothing happens to make sure that women don't have to go through this, then it's just a blip on the radar.
Thank you, Rochelle Riley, Detroit Free Press columnist and author of The Burden, African Americans and Enduring Impact of Slavery, which will be released next year. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Current State. If you live in a large city like Lansing, Detroit, or Grand Rapids, you might take your access to high-speed broadband for granted. But for some residents in Michigan, that's far from their reality. The Bridge magazine took a closer look at broadband in rural Michigan, and Ted Roloffs wrote the article, which we've linked to on WKAR.org, and he joins us now. Welcome to Current State.
Good to be with you.
Overall, 37% of residents in rural areas of Michigan have no access to high-speed broadband. So where are some of the worst cases?
Well, it's pockets all around the state. There's a couple counties, I think, up north that you have 100% of people in rural areas that have no access to high-speed internet. And there's other counties where it's 75%. It's not exclusive to the Upper Peninsula. You'll find a lot of it in the northern lower, but as well as many other areas in rural Michigan. So it's not just one part of the state. It's really all over.
Do you have an example of a specific city and or area and how it really affected them?
Well, you could look anywhere. I mean, I focused on this township outside of Ann Arbor where, you know, kind of a rare event. They had a millage last August, and it was a 2-to-1 vote in support of nearly a 3-mill tax to bring in fiber optic cable into that township. And that's not an insignificant amount of millage for a township to approve. It kind of shows how a lot of people value that. And the consequences, I focused on one particular family, a pilot who couldn't even download links from his airline's website to give him his next flight assignment. It would just freeze up. He couldn't load it. So he has to go to the library to do that. He has to go to the library to download required training and safety videos that they have to watch. And it also affects children in school who can't access YouTube help links that teachers give them. So it has consequences both for people in their employment, for people who want to try to build a business from their home, and also for students in that situation.
So what's being done to address the problem?
Well, there's some federal money that's going to try to bring more high-speed broadband and to expand it out to where it is right now. It's not enough money right now to really solve the problem, and the program that funded that which I think was launched in 2014, that had a lower standard than the most recent standard for broadband speed. So even the people that get internet through that are not going to have the broadband download speed, which they're now recommending, which is 25 megabits per second. So it's kind of a piecemeal solution. You've got this township in Ann Arbor. They're going to have high-speed fiber optic at the end of next year because of that millage. But and there's another township near there that I think is also planning a millage sometime next year. But that's kind of piece by piece, township by township. So as of right now, there's really no magic wand solution to this issue.
We've been talking with Ted Roloffs, who wrote an article for The Bridge magazine about lack of access to high-speed broadband here in Michigan. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to do it.
So I love my dog as much as I love you.
You're listening to Current State. Dogs that are trained to sniff out explosives are common sight in airports and major sporting events, but very few police dogs can track the scent of a device that's being carried on a person in motion. Michigan State University has one of those canines. WKER's Kevin Lavery saw the dogs training in action and brings us this story.
Tip-off for today's game with Notre Dame, 7 o'clock.
Long before the fans came to watch the Spartans duke it out with the Fighting Irish on the hardwood, police from both Michigan State University and the University of Notre Dame were keeping watch at the Breslin Center. Working in pairs, the teams put their eyes, ears, and noses to the task of maintaining public safety. MSU policeman Adam Atkinson was on duty with his partner, Cora. She's a little young for a cop, but she's already a trusted member of the force.
She's a 2.5-year-old yellow Labrador Retriever.
Cora holds a special place in the canine corps. She's a vape wake dog. That's not a breed, it's a brand. Developed at Auburn University, Vape Wake is a program in which dogs are trained to track the vapors that are emitted by explosive devices. Atkinson says that's a departure from the way bomb dogs were trained in the past.
When you look at how events are normally ran with explosive detecting dogs, the dogs would come in ahead of time and search before the crowd arrived. Now we have dogs that can not only search ahead of time, but they can also search during and after the games.
The human body produces heat. When we're sitting or standing, our thermal plume rises silently and invisibly above our heads. But when we're walking, the plume trails along behind us. Dogs are very good at detecting those molecules. A person carrying an explosive device emits a heat signature that's part body and part bomb. A well-trained dog can locate a would-be perpetrator, even in a crowd of thousands of people.
Please be aware that all patrons are subject to a visual search.
The Vape Wake program taps into a dog's genetics to develop animals that can rise to the task. Officer Atkinson says from the time they're born, puppies are tested to perform in all sorts of environments.
They have to be able to work in extreme heat, extreme cold, when there is a lot of people around, and just focus on what their job is. And I believe they select dogs that have that passion to want to work.
It's not all work. We're talking about dogs, after all, an animal that lives for playtime.
Where's your ball? Where's your ball? Huh?
This loquacious lab is named Skeet. He came up from South Bend to help out at the big game. His canine colleague, Toxie, is more subdued.
Toxie?
Yep, Toxie. I didn't name her, but it suits her quite well.
Officer Jarrett Gilpin is a police officer at the University of Notre Dame. Toxie has never discovered a real explosive in the real world, thank goodness. But Gilpin says in training, she sniffed out a lot of interesting finds.
Shoe polish. Fertilizer, packing solution, some kind of Teflon-coated packing solution they found. It's kind of amazing.
At 5:30, the gates have opened at the Breslin, and Toxie, Skeet, and Cora are down the hall, hard at work. Vapor detection dogs are not meant to take the place of traditional police animals. MSU officer Adam Atkinson notes that other dogs are trained for different missions. But he says in the post-9/11 era, Cora, the yellow lab, brings a skill set that meets a changing security environment.
These dogs search super fast, so they can search a large area. They're sniffing people as they're walking through, so it just gives us that extra security blanket, another way to help protect people.
So as thousands of people cheered MSU on to victory over Notre Dame on Thursday, the Breslin Center stayed safe, thanks in no small measure to a three-dog night. Celebrate, celebrate, dance to the music. For WKAR, I'm Kevin Lavery. Dance to the music.
Okay, let's transition now from smart dogs to smart fish. Well, smart robotic fish. MSU researchers are using a grant from the National Science Foundation to continue their study and construction of underwater robots. WKAR's Katie Cook dived into this story for us.
At first glance, if you saw it underwater, you might mistake it for an actual fish.
The first prototype that we built was significantly smaller, but this one is bigger and yellow.
But Grace, as she's been named, is a robot.
The big improvement about this robot is the fact that you can take off the head. The head goes on here.
PhD student Osama Inasser is demonstrating how the head of the robotic fish can come off. Made of carbon fiber and painted yellow with a green MSU Spartan helmet on the tail, Grace is about 3 feet long.
Grace stands for Gliding Robot, ACE. ACE. ACE just means good, right? And grace means actually it moves with grace. Actually, it does.
That's Jabot Tan, the MSU Foundation professor of the College of Engineering and co-principal investigator on this project, along with his partner, Vaibhav Srivastava, assistant professor in MSU's College of Engineering. The purpose of the project is to help humans and robots collaborate more effectively. The researchers are intertwining humans' abilities to recognize patterns and missing information with robots' abilities to quickly process large sums of information.
Robots and humans have different strengths and weaknesses. As humans, we are always, I still think they are the smartest animals on the planet. Oh, well, not just animals, but smartest machines, I guess, as well. We can deal with sophisticated scenarios, and we have a lot of subtle understanding of the environment and the other processes involved. Robots, on the other hand, they are, oftentimes, they don't have feelings yet. And also, they can do hard work. We send them to do hard work, tedious work, dangerous work.
A robotic fish like Grace has several uses.
For example, you can use it to monitor water quality. You can monitor, for example, harmful algal blooms. You can perform surveillance in water just to monitor whether there are enemy ships or other types of vessels in the environment. One application we have been working on is tracking the movement of live fish species in lakes.
But one main area of focus in this research is to use the robots for search and rescue missions.
These robots are supposed to be energy efficient so that they can work on water for a long time, and they just swim around or glide around, collect imagery. And then they would send the imagery back to surface, to a boat, or personnel on boat, and the people would be able to look at the images and make some decisions.
Underwater robotics is an active field already, but this research at MSU is building on current technology. They recently took Grace 2.1 for a field test in Higgins Lake, Michigan.
So interestingly, we had a leak. It is reality. We had a leak, actually, twice. First time we fixed it, and second time the leak caused the robot to sink to the bottom of the lake, which was, at that particular location, was about 70 feet. We started a search and rescue mission, I guess.
The search and rescue mission for the search and rescue robot was a success. And now the plan is to troubleshoot and work on improvements, starting with that pesky leak.
Where was the leak?
We're still trying to figure that out.
They have a patent on the technology and hope to sell it to others in the future so it can be used by many and potentially save lives. For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
Next, learn about the blast of Arctic air headed our way. A candid conversation with two high school football players who kneeled during the national anthem and why they say they had to transfer from their school.
I couldn't be a student there. I didn't feel good as a student. I didn't feel good walking through the halls.
And a new exhibit on Michigan's role in World War I.